Once again, I gaze upon the Great Pyramid of Cheops. Only this time, I see several ideas. The first is sheer spiritual audacity. Human beings aspire to be more than human. The other is wonder. Sacred sites tell us that we are wondrous creatures who should be doing wondrous works. And you can still see that here. The vertical assembly building at the Kennedy Space Center is tall enough to hold a Saturn V moon rocket upright and has proportions boggling the mind. This building is also an idea, the idea that we will find our origins and our cosmic family. Giant rockets blast off. If a single bacterium comes back from deep space, we will have found our own cosmic seed. As the old myths wear out, new ones spring up in our souls. We crave to know that we are sacred once again. The deepest levels of the quantum domain are the common ground where our hands reach out to touch God. What we touch is divine, but it is also ourselves. Seven Stages of God. If you don't make yourself equal to God, you can't perceive God. From an anonymous Christian heretic in the 3rd century. We are now ready to answer the simplest but most profound question. Who is God? One must assume that God leaves no fingerprints in the material world. This gives us no choice but to find a substitute for infinity that retains something of God. The book of Genesis declares that God created Adam in his own image, but we have been returning the favor almost since the beginning, fashioning God in our image over and over again. The same I that gives a person a sense of identity extends beyond the physical body, expanding to embrace nature, the universe, and ultimately pure spirit. To anyone who worships God as the self, it is obvious that none of us are alone. The self isn't personal ego, but a pervasive presence that cannot be escaped. The God of any religion is only a fragment of God. There are seven versions of God which can be associated with organized faiths. Stage 1, God the Protector. Stage 2, God the Almighty. Stage 3, God of Peace. Stage 4, God the Redeemer. Stage 5, God the Creator. Stage 6, God of Miracles. Stage 7, God of Pure Being. I Am. Each stage meets a particular human need. In the face of nature's overwhelming forces, humans needed a God who would protect them from harm. When they felt they had broken the law or committed wrongdoing, people turned to a God who would judge them and redeem their sins. In this way, purely from self-interest, the project of creating God in our own image proceeded, and continues to proceed. We are not comparing religions here. No stage is absolute in its claim to truth. Each one implies a different relationship, however. In the progress from stage 1 to stage 7, the wide gap between God and his worshippers becomes narrower and eventually closes. We keep creating God in our image for more than vanity. We want to achieve intimacy. Unless we can see ourselves in the mirror, we will never see God there. Consider the list again, and you will see how God shifts in response to very human situations. God is a protector to those who see themselves in danger. God is almighty to those who want power or lack any way of getting power. God brings peace to those who have discovered their own inner world. God redeems those who are conscious of committing a sin. God is the creator when we wonder where the world came from. God is behind miracles when the laws of nature are suddenly revoked without warning. God is existence itself, I am, to those who feel ecstasy and a sense of pure being. The issue isn't how many gods exist, but how completely our own needs can be spiritually fulfilled. When someone asks, "Is there really a God?" the most legitimate answer is, "Who's asking?" The perceiver is intimately linked to his perceptions. From the virtual level, which is our source, the qualities of spirit flow until they reach us in the material world. On the material plane, the brain is our only way of registering reality, and spirit must be filtered through biology. Each response of the brain, from fight or flight through intuition to the sacred response, is a natural response of the human nervous system, and we were all born with the ability to experience the entire range. These are well-documented facts, but I wish to take a step further. I contend that the brain responds uniquely in every phase of spiritual life. Scientific research is incomplete at the higher stages of inner growth, but we know that where the spirit leads, the body follows. Faith healers do exist who transcend medical explanation. Saints in every religion have been observed to live on little or no food. Visions of God have been so credible that their wisdom moved and guided the lives of millions. We select a deity based on our interpretation of reality, and that interpretation is rooted in biology. We can match each biological response, in fact, with a specific self-image. In the fight or flight response, identity is based on the physical body and the physical environment. In the reactive response, identity is based on ego and personality. In the restful awareness response, identity is based on the silent witness. In the intuitive response, identity is based on the knower within. In the creative response, identity is based on co-creator with God. In the visionary response, identity is based on enlightenment. And in the sacred response, identity is based on the source of all that is. You have a clear outline of the stages of human growth. It is undeniable that complete inner growth is a tremendous challenge. If you are trapped in traffic, blood boiling with frustration, higher thoughts are blocked out. These higher responses we call more spiritual, but in any situation, the brain is responding from the highest level it can. The deeper mystery centers on our ability to rise from an animal instinct to sainthood. We will examine what each stage means and how a person rises up the ladder of inner growth. Despite the enormous flexibility of the nervous system, we fall into habits and repeated patterns because of our reliance on old imprints. This is never more true than with our beliefs. In every religion, there is the same streak of fear whenever a person is certain that the world is dominated by threat, danger, and sin. Yet every religion also contains love whenever the world is perceived as abundant, loving, and nourishing. It is all projection. The wonder is that the human nervous system can operate on so many planes. We don't just navigate these dimensions, we explore them, meld them together, and create new worlds around ourselves. If you do not understand that you are multidimensional, then the whole notion of God runs off the rails. Like a child growing up, we have to evolve toward a more complete vision, until the day arrives when we can see the whole as God does. Reality itself may be only a symbol for the workings of God's mind, and in that case, the primitive belief found throughout the ancient and pagan world that God exists in every blade of grass, in every creature, and even the earth and sky may contain the highest truth. Arriving at that truth is the purpose of spiritual life, and each stage of God takes us on a journey whose endpoint is total clarity, a sense of peace that nothing can disturb. Stage 1, guard the protector. Fight or flight response. Neurologists have long divided the brain into old and new. The new brain is an organ to be proud of. When you have a reasoned thought, it is the new brain, primarily the cerebral cortex, that comes into play. But the old brain wants its due. This is the part of us that claws for survival and is willing to kill, if need be, to protect us. The old brain is reflected in a god who seems primordial and largely unforgiving. He knows who his enemies are. He doesn't come from the school of forgive and forget. God is very dangerous in stage one. He uses nature to punish even his most favored children through storms, floods, earthquakes, and disease. Primitive man experienced untold threats from the environment. Despite his frightening temper, God the Protector was as necessary to life as a father is inside a family. The old brain isn't logical. It fires off impulses that destroy logic in favor of strong emotions and instant reflexes. The favorite response of the old brain is to lash out in its own defense, which is why the fight or flight response serves as its main trigger. In crisis, we are all thrown back on a deep sense of physical danger. The loss of a job can feel like a matter of life and death. People wrangling over a bitter divorce at times act as if their former spouse has become a mortal enemy. The fact that the old brain exerts its influence age after age accounts for the durability of God's role as protector. Because his role is to protect, the God of stage one fails when the weak fall prey to illness, tragedy, or violence. He succeeds whenever we escape danger and survive crisis. In the mood of triumph, his devotees feel chosen. They exult over their enemies and once again feel safe, for a while, because heaven is on their side. Reason teaches us that aggression begets retaliation. We know this undeniably, given the tragic history of war. But there is a wall between the logic of the new brain, which is based upon reflection, observation, and the ability to see beyond bare survival, and the logic of the old brain. The old brain fights first, or runs away, and asks questions later. At each stage, the basic question, "Who is God?" immediately raises other questions. The first of these is, "Who am I?" In stage one, identity is based upon the physical body and the environment. Survival is the foremost consideration here. When they asked, "Who am I?" the earliest writers of scripture knew that they were mortals subject to disease and famine. These conditions had to have a reason. Therefore, the family relationship with God got worked out in terms of sin, disobedience, and ignorance. Even so, God remained on the scene. He watches over Adam and Eve, despite the curse put upon them, and after a while he finds enough virtue in their descendant Noah to save him from the sentence of death. Rather than viewing the God of stage one harshly, we need to realize how realistic he is. Life has been incredibly hard for many people, and deep psychological wounds are inflicted in family life. The God of stage one salves these wounds and gives us a reason to believe that we will survive. At the same time, he fuels our needs. As long as we need a protector, we will cling to the role of children. In crisis, people seek ways to cope, and in stage one, God is a coping mechanism. To escape complete despair, people will project beyond hopelessness, finding solace in a God who wants to protect them. An absolute standard of good and evil is something many people crave, particularly at a time when values seem to be crumbling. In stage one, good and evil seem to be very clear. Good derives from being safe. Evil derives from being in danger. But is the picture really so clear? Social workers are well aware that abused children have a strange desire to defend their parents. If you try to remove the child from the abusive environment, he's deeply afraid that you are snatching away his source of love. The old brain has an overriding need for security, which is why so many abused wives defend their husbands and return to them. Good and evil become hopelessly confused. The God of stage one is just as ambiguous. Even if he is worshipped as a benign parent, his goodness is tainted by suffering. A father who provides with great love and generosity would be considered a good father, but not if he tortures a child. Anyone who considers himself a child of God has to consider this problem. Much of the time, it is papered over. The need for security is too great. Yet if the God of stage one is double-edged, providing with one hand and punishing with the other, then he cannot be known only one way. Fear and love both come into play. It takes a great deal of growing up before one can live with ambivalence and its constant blending of dark and light, love and hate. This is the road not taken in stage one. Some children try to preserve innocence by denying that its opposite exists. They turn into idealists and wishful thinkers. They show a strong streak of denial when anything negative takes place and will remain anxious until a situation turns positive again. Other children take sides, assigning all the anxiety-provoking traits to a bad parent while labeling the other as always good. The good parent-bad parent solution takes the form of a cosmic battle between God and Satan. In the Old Testament, Jehovah is cruel enough to assume the role of bad parent by himself. However, there must be an adversary, the literal meaning of Satan's name, to take the blame away from God. Never once is he described as an aspect of God. The division between the two makes for a much simpler story. The other coping strategy, which involves denying the negative and seeking always to be positive, is just as common in religion. A lot of harm has to be overlooked to make God totally benign, yet people manage to do so. The power of interpretation is linked to consciousness. Things can't exist if you're not conscious of them. In religious terms, the deity is still perfect, meaning that he's always right, because those he punishes must be wrong. In stage one, God has to be right. If he isn't, the world becomes too dangerous to live in. Every stage of God implies a life challenge, which can be expressed in terms of highest aspiration. If you are surrounded by threats, to survive is a high aspiration. However, even in the worst situations, a person aspires to do more than cope. You might think that the next step would be escape. However, a child can't escape his family, just as famine victims often can't escape drought. So the mind turns instead to imitating God. And since God is a protector, we try to protect the most valuable things in life. Stage one is the most social of all the seven worlds we will examine. Here one learns to be responsible and caring. The reward for learning to protect others is that in return, they give you their love and respect. Outright defiance is the worst response to a protector, who then feels completely justified in holding you to the letter of the law, just as Jehovah felt justified in punishing infractions of his law. It isn't hard to figure out what you have to do to survive in a harsh world. You have to show courage in the face of adversity. No amount of effort will totally appease this God. The courage to fight must eventually turn into the courage to oppose him. As in an abusive family, the devotee of a fearful God will not move on to a higher stage until he says, "I am tired of being afraid. You are not my God if I have to hide from your anger." As organized religions demonstrate, it is possible to live a long time with an angry, jealous, unfair God even though he's supposed to be the highest judge. Ultimately, one must learn to live with ambivalence. The important issue is psychological. How much fear are you willing to live with? When this hurdle is cleared, when personal integrity is more important than being accepted within the system, a new stage begins. Translate this to an inner war, with one voice urging rebellion and the other threatening punishment for breaking the law, and you have the core drama of stage one. You would think from the story of Adam and Eve that God's children were tempted to sin. But to me, the guardian wants you to obey. Therefore, he must make disobedience a wrongful act. God's temptation is to become a tyrant. Tyranny is protection that has gone too far. The tyrant, more often than not, has to be deposed, overthrown by force. In some societies, as in some families, this happens through violence. But short of violence, there is a subtler mechanism for escaping any temptation, which is to see through the need for it. In spiritual terms, God's protection is valued only by denying that He's also the source of the threat. In the end, nothing is outside the deity, so asking Him to protect you from storms, famine, disease, and misfortune is the same as asking the perpetrator. The central question in stage one is this: why did God have to make such a frightening world? To get out of stage one, you must arrive at a new interpretation of all the issues raised so far. Who is God? What kind of world did He create? Who am I? How do I fit in? In stage two, the basic problem of survival has been overcome. Even so, the God of stage one, like the reptilian brain, is a permanent legacy that everyone confronts before inner growth can be achieved. Stage 2, God the Almighty. Reactive response. If stage 1 is about survival, stage 2 is about power. There is no doubt that God has all the power which He jealously guards. At the beginning of the scientific era, when the secrets of electricity were being discovered and the elements charted, many worried that it was sacrilege to look too closely at how God worked. Power was not only His, but rightfully so. Our place was to obey, a view that makes perfect sense if you consider heaven the goal of life. Who would endanger his soul just to know how lightning works? Freud points out, however, that power is irresistible. The kind of God implied by the drive to power is dangerous. But he's more civilized than the God of stage one. He is worshipped by those who have formed a stable society, one that needs laws and governance. The Almighty is not so willful as his predecessor. He still metes out punishment, but you can understand why. The wrongdoer disobeyed a law, something he knows in advance not to do. Justice is no longer so rough. The kings and judges who take their power from God do so with a sense of being righteous. They deserve their power, or so they tell themselves. The drama of power is based on the reactive response, a biological need to fulfill ego demands. This response has not been studied well. We can surmise that it is associated with the midbrain, which lies between the oldest animal structures of the old brain and the rationality of the cerebral cortex. Studies in infant development began to demonstrate that almost from the moment of birth, some newborns are outgoing, demanding, bold, and curious, while others are introverted, undemanding, and shy. These traits remain for life. This implies that the ego response is built into us. The ruling dictum of the reactive response is more for me. Taken too far, this leads to corruption, since eventually an insatiable appetite must run into the desires of others. We find no altruistic gods in world mythology. The first commandment given to Moses is, "You shall place no other god before me." Jehovah survives all competitors in the Old Testament. But in other systems, such as the Greek and the Hindu, the war for power is constant. The Judaic God is a surprising victor in his emergence from a small conquered nation that had 10 of its 12 tribes wiped off the face of the earth. Yet the subjugated Hebrews projected a stable, unshakable God, the first God Almighty to survive all challengers. Jehovah succeeded because he exemplified a world that was fast evolving, the world of competition and ambition. The God of Stage 2 has structured a hierarchical world, one in which you can appeal to the king or the judge. The struggle to bring in laws to replace sheer might divides Stage 1 and Stage 2, although power exposes you to the temptation to trample other people's needs. To prevent this, we have a new God, an omnipotent judge, who threatens even the most powerful king with retribution if he goes too far. Every parent is aware of the phase in a toddler's life associated with the terrible twos when power dawns. The two-year-old who throws tantrums, coaxes, wheedles, and manipulates any situation to get his way is testing his ego boundaries. Exasperated as they might get, good parents realize that balance grows out of excess. Without the testing of limits, the ego would either be cowed into submission or lost in grandiose fantasies. From its first days, the ego finds that making things go your way isn't automatic. This contest of competing egos creates the drama of Stage 2. If you know yourself to be competitive and ambitious, it goes without saying that at some level you have given your allegiance to the god of this stage. Society rewards these traits so much that we tend to overlook their roots. The ego forms a bridge from the family, where your needs and whims are indulged, to the setting of school, where rules override your whims and many other children are taken into account. The ego is always tempted to return to the infant paradise, in which food and love came automatically without competition. This fantasy comes to the surface in adults who believe that they deserve everything they have earned, no matter by what means. The fantasy of getting everything for me doesn't often come true. However, this isn't the time for the meek to inherit the earth. Stage 2 is dominated by a god who justifies strength and competition with no thought that being a loser is possible. The theme of Stage 2 can be summarized as winning is next to godliness. The Almighty approves of accomplishment. The Protestant work ethic sealed his approval into dogma. Those who work the hardest will get the greatest reward. But did this belief actually derive from spiritual insight? Or did people find themselves in a world where work needed to be done and added God's stamp of approval afterward? In Stage 1, the fall from Eden brings Adam and Eve the curse of having to labor until you return to the dust from whence you came. For work to be glorified now in Stage 2 seems contradictory, yet this is exactly how inner growth proceeds. Each stage involves a change of perspective or even a new worldview. If we take the Bible as our authority, there is ample evidence to support the notion that God approves of work, competition, and winning. None of the kings of Israel is punished for going to war. In fact, most of the Old Testament victories require miracles or God's blessings to be achieved. On the other hand, Jesus is adamantly opposed to war, and in general, to work. The Sermon on the Mount is in favor of letting God handle all earthly needs. Do not store up for yourselves treasure on earth, where it grows rusty and moth-eaten, and thieves break in to steal it. Store up treasure in heaven instead. No servant can be a slave to two masters. You cannot serve God and mammon, money. This sort of talk was disturbing. In the first place, it undercut the power of the rich. Even if you ignore the letter of what is being said, society has found countless ways to serve God and money at the same time. Jesus doesn't equate power with achievement, work, planning, saving, or accumulation. All are necessary in order to build wealth, wage war, or divide the strong from the weak. These were the very goals that Jesus did not want to further. Therefore, his rejection of power makes perfect sense. He wanted the human wolves to lie down with the lambs. Stage 2 is much less paralyzed by fear of God than Stage 1, but the next closest emotion to fear, awe, is much present. This new God punishes by the rules. Most of his rules make sense in broad outline. Every society mandates against murder, theft, lying, and coveting property that belongs to someone else. As long as the deity inspires awe, the way to him is through blind obedience. In this stage, the hidden question is, can God really make good on his threats? The Almighty has to make sure that no one is tempted to find out, which means that he must exhibit his strength. The righteous must receive tangible rewards. The wrongdoers must feel his wrath. For fear of hurting ourselves, we pull away from disobedience, even though we have never experienced divine punishment in real life. To this end, we take ordinary misfortunes such as illness, bankruptcy, and loss of loved ones and interpret them as coming from God. Obedience isn't an end unto itself. For obeying God's laws, the worshipper expects a reward. In stage 2, this takes the form of getting what you want. God permits you to fulfill your desires, and he makes you feel righteous in the bargain. In his role as Almighty, the deity now begins to answer prayers. In this value system, the rich can clothe themselves in virtue, while the poor are morally suspect and seem shameful. Measuring good and evil according to rewards has its pitfalls. The ego has to figure out how to aggrandize me, while at the same time being good. Rarely does the solution emerge as pure honesty and cooperation. As a result, manipulation is born. The goal of manipulation is to get what you want, but not look bad in the process. This calculus is very important if you fear that God is watching and keeping tabs. Are these simply the kinds of shortcuts we are all tempted to use in order to get our way? If you turn to the Old Testament, there is no mistaking that God himself is manipulative. Praising those who hew to the law, withdrawing to show anger, sending an endless string of prophets to attack sin through preaching that stirs up guilt, we continue to use the same tactics in society, pressuring conformity to what the majority believe is good, while disguising the evils that are done to the band of wrong thinkers, pacifists, radicals, communists, etc., who refuse to fall into line. Stage 2 isn't just a matter of naked power. It brings a sense of optimism to life. The world exists to be explored and conquered. Ego gives you strength, although its lessons are often painful. The Buddhist doctrine of ego death as a road to enlightenment is something most people cannot accept. It goes as follows. The more you center your life on I, me, mine, the more insecure you will become. Even worse, it makes you identify with externals, and that can only wind up leaving you empty inside. Convincing as the benefits of ego death may sound, few people would willingly sacrifice the needs of I, me, mine. In stage 2, this is particularly true because God gives his blessing to those who achieve. In stage 2, the ego is so bent on accomplishment that it ignores the threat of emptiness. Power for its own sake has no meaning, and the challenge of acquiring more and more power, along with its symbols in terms of money and status, still leaves a huge vacuum of meaning. This is why absolute loyalty is demanded by God at this stage. to keep the faithful from looking too deeply inside. The harder road would be to heal the disorder of our inner life. This is the choice that carries everyone from stage 2 to stage 3. Anyone who finds satisfaction in being an accomplished, skilled worker will find stage 2 a very tempting place to rest on the spiritual journey. Often, the only ones who break free to a higher stage have had some drastic failure in their lives. Failure carries its own dangers, primarily that you will see yourself as a victim, which makes the chances for spiritual progress worse than ever. But it does raise questions about some basic beliefs in stage 2. If you worked hard, why didn't God reward you? Does He lack the power to bestow good fortune? Or has He forgotten you entirely? As long as such doubts don't arise, the God of Stage 2 is the perfect deity for a competitive market economy. However, there is still the problem of guilt. Despite its external rewards, Stage 2 is associated with the birth of guilt. Someone has to lay down the commandments defining absolute right and wrong. Afterward, the law-abiding will enforce their own obedience. In the family, a 2-year-old who tries to steal a cookie is reprimanded by his mother and told that what he is doing is wrong. Until that point, taking a cookie isn't stealing. It is just following what your ego wants to do. If the child repeats the same act again, it turns into stealing because he's breaking a commandment and some form of punishment will follow. Now, the child is caught between two forces, the pleasure of doing what he wants and the pain of being punished. The child sets up his own boundaries. He will take a cookie when it is right, permitted by the mother, and not take one when it is wrong, causes guilt through a bad conscience. Freud called this the development of the superego, our internal rule maker. Stage 2 brings the comfort of laws clearly set down, but it traps you into putting too much value on rules and boundaries to the detriment of inner growth. It's no coincidence that a wealthy and privileged society is so prone to rampant addictions. Stage 2 is based on pleasure, and when pleasure becomes obsessive, the result is addiction. Stage 2 is also power-based, and power is notoriously selfish. The God of Stage 2 is jealous of his power over us because it pleases him. He's addicted to control, and like human addiction, the implication is that God is not satisfied, no matter how much control He exerts. Psychiatrists meet people every day who complain about the emotional turmoil in their lives and yet are blindly addicted to drama. Other addictions are also based on behavior, the need to have something wrong in your life, or to create it if it doesn't exist. The obsession over things going wrong. This is the what-if addiction. And finally, the compulsion to be perfect at all costs. This last addiction has taken secular form in people who crave the perfect family, perfect home, and perfect career. They do not see that such perfection can be bought only at the price of killing our inborn spontaneity, which by its nature can never be controlled. There is a corresponding spiritual state, however, that aims to please God through a life that has no blemish whatever. In the loyalty oath of Psalm 101, the believer makes promises no one could live up to. I will set before myself no sordid aim. I will reject all crooked thoughts. I will have no dealing with evil. Such absolutism itself amounts to an addiction, and it is here in stage 2 that fanaticism is born. The fanatic must purify his very thoughts. Complete control over the mind is unachievable, but this doesn't prevent him from imposing ever stricter vigilance on crooked thoughts, his and other people's. Those who get stuck in stage 2 lose sight of the actual goal of spiritual life, to free humans and allow them to live in innocence and love. This cannot be repaired until the devotee stops being so concerned with the law. To do that, he must find an inner life, which will never happen as long as he's policing his own desires. When a person begins to see that life is more than trying to be perfect, the bad old desires rear their heads again. Only this time they are seen as natural, not evil, and the road is open for stage three. It comes as a source of wonder when turning inward breaks the spell of I, me, mine, and ends its cravings. Stage three, God of Peace, Restful Awareness Response. Whether unleashing floods or inciting warfare, the God we've seen so far relishes struggle. Obedience to Him has mattered far more than our own needs. The balance begins to shift when we find we can meet our own needs. It takes no God up there to bring peace and wisdom, because the cerebral cortex already contains a mechanism for both. When a person stops focusing on outer activity, closes his eyes and relaxes, brain activity alters. The dominance of alpha wave rhythms signals a state of rest that is aware at the same time. Blood pressure and heart rate decrease, accompanied by lessened oxygen consumption. These changes do not sound overly impressive, but the effect can be dramatic. Peace replaces the mind's chaotic activity. Inner turmoil ceases. The Psalms declare, "Be still and know that I am God." This is the God of stage three. Stage three transcends the willful, demanding God that once prevailed, just as the new brain transcends the old. Only by discovering that peace lies within does the devotee find a place that divine vengeance and retribution cannot touch. This forms the basis of contemplation and meditation in every tradition. The first solid research on the restful awareness response came with the study of mantra meditation in the 1960s and the 1970s. Early experiments at the Menninger Foundation established that some yogis could lower their heart rate and breathing almost to nil. They should have been on the brink of death. Instead, they reported intense inner peace, bliss, and oneness with God. Nor was this phenomenon simply a curiosity from the East. In December 1577, a Spanish monk in the town of Avila was thrown into a church prison. The monk underwent horrendous torture. His unlit cell was actually a small cupboard, not high enough for him to stand erect. He was taken each day to the rectory, where the monks walked around him, scourging his bare back with their leather whips. While imprisoned in his dark cupboard, St. John of the Cross begged for a pen and paper so he could record his ecstatic inner experiences. "On a dark, secret night, starving for love and deep in flame, oh happy, lucky flight, unseen I slipped away. My house at last was calm and safe." These opening lines from Dark Night describe the escape of the soul from the body, which delivers the poet from pain to joy. But for this to happen, the brain has to detach inner experience from outer. In medicine, we run across instances where patients seem remarkably immune to pain. In cases of advanced psychosis, someone who has become catatonic is rigid and unresponsive. We cannot simply lump a great poet and saint, however, with the mentally ill. "All ceased. I left my being, leaving my cares to fade among the lilies, far away." St. John describes with precisely chosen words the transition from the material level to the quantum level, where physical pain and suffering have no bearing. Lying beneath the spiritual beauty of the experience is the restful awareness response. To put yourself in a comparable situation, imagine that you are a marathon runner. Marathons test the body's extremes of endurance and pain. At a certain point, long-distance runners enter the zone, a place that transcends physical discomfort. In the zone, one expands beyond the limits of the body, touching the wholeness and oneness of everything. The God of Peace is meditative. The God of Stage 3 is a God of Peace because He shows the way out of struggle. There is no peace in the outer world, which is ruled by struggle. people who attempt to control their environment, I am thinking of perfectionists and others caught up in obsessive behavior, have refused the invitation to find an inner solution. One man told me he had torn his Achilles tendon in a fateful game of racquetball, only instead of being in excruciating pain, he felt extremely calm and detached. It is common for people to break into stage 3 with this kind of abruptness. In place of an active, excited mind, they find a silent witness. Some people jump immediately into religion. Others register the whole thing simply as detachment. Medically, we know that the brain can cancel out awareness of pain. Yet endorphins, the brain's own version of morphine, are not enough to account for St. John's ecstasy. The brain does not give itself a simple injection of opiates when pain is present. There are many situations where pain cannot be overcome, and sometimes it takes a trick to get the brain to react. If you take people suffering from intractable pain, a certain number will get relief if you inject them with saline solution while telling them that it is a powerful narcotic. The whole area of treatment is psychological. It is a matter of changing someone's interpretation. In between the pain and the brain, something must intervene that decides how much discomfort is going to be felt. It is just as normal to feel no pain as it is to feel a great deal. To someone who has entered stage 3, the decision maker is the presence of God bringing peace, and the pain being relieved includes the pain of the soul caught in turmoil. By going inward, the devotee has found a way to stop that pain. In many ways, finding your center is the great gift of stage 3, and the God of peace exists to assure his worshipper that there is a place of refuge from fear and confusion. A warrior God didn't settle the turbulent history of the chosen people, nor did laying down countless laws. The God of peace can't simply dictate an end to strife and struggle. Either human nature has to change, or else it must disclose a new aspect that transcends violence. In stage 3, the new aspect is centeredness. If you find your own inner quiet, the issue of violence is solved, at least for you personally. A friend of mine who has been deeply influenced by Buddhism says that if you can find the motionless point at your core, you are at the center of the whole universe. Haven't you noticed driving down the highway that you can pretend not to be moving? You remain still while the road and everything else is flowing past you. That still point is the silent witness. Buddhism doesn't believe that personality is real. The fact that I am over 50, Indian, a physician by training, married with 2 children and so forth, doesn't describe the real me. These qualities have chosen to roost together and form the illusion of an identity. In this lifetime, I preferred to be male rather than female, Eastern rather than Western, married rather than single, and so on. I am so bound up in these preferences that I actually think they are me. But in Buddhism, my choices will dissolve in the wind once I give up this body. So who am I? I am nothing except the still point of awareness at my center. To realize this truth is to be free, so Buddhism teaches. Therefore, seeing yourself as a motionless point while driving down the freeway becomes a valued experience. You are one step closer to finding out who you really are.